afternoon, everyone. This is our regular scheduled meeting for the City of Morro Bay Water Reclamation Facility Citizens Advisory Committee. And we have three members missing today, but we have a quorum, so we will proceed. So I will call the meeting to order. So let's have a moment of silence and maybe think about the vets that we had Vets Day this week, and maybe we can thank them for what they've done for us. Thank you, and now let's stand for the Pledge of Allegiance. Ready? Begin.
I pledge allegiance to my flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
Okay, we usually start off with announcements and or presentations, and I would turn that off over to no one. So it doesn't look like. Do you have anything, Mike?
We don't have any announcements from the program management team, other than what's being presented in item C1.
In the agenda. All right. Okay, public comment. We have a pretty. Oh yes, Paul.
Normally we have under old business and subcommittee.
We'll get there. No, that's in the agenda.
We don't have that on today's agenda, so I thought I'd take this moment.
Is your microphone on?
I thought I clipped it on. Can you hear me now?
There you go.
No, it's not.
Well, you use another one.
Here we go.
Try
another.
Here
we go. Right.
Yeah, that's better. And our subcommittee, which would be Valerie, myself, and Dale, and thanks to Valerie for arranging this with Bruce. We had a tour with Bruce at the existing wastewater treatment plant on last Thursday. And I tell you, having done that and then rereading the tech memos, it gives you that aha moment. So we really would urge everyone to take advantage of Bruce here and go down at the plant and get a little spiel. It really is an eye-opener. I thought it was helpful. So that's what I have to report. I don't know if any of the other committees wanted to report on that.
Thank you. Anyone else have anything to say? Richard?
Yeah, the last meeting I mentioned the OPC having the Prop 1 funding, and also how user-friendly and easy they are to do that. And I have a little form here that I'm going to submit to you guys, and it kind of shows how easy it is to do it. Once again, we are a disadvantaged community that we could take advantage of those opportunities, and I just encourage our build team to really look closely into that.
Before I forget it, I, on Paul's tour of the facility here in Morro Bay, thanks, Bruce, for allowing us to do that. And I think I'll take you up on it in the near future, and I appreciate you letting us do that. That's good. Also, I had a chance to go to the one in Los Osos, and I think that as well is a very informative tour, as well as their status and where they are in the construction and how they control it and what is their software and so forth and so on. And I think that was very interesting as well. So there's reciprocity there, so we should do both those things.
Yeah. Okay, can you hear me? Is it on?
Yeah.
Good, okay. Just one question. What is the due date for the Prop 1 funding grant that he gave you the information?
Yes. According to this, the due date is December 1st.
December 1st. Hopefully we're going to make that, right?
Well, we have passed information on to Kestrel. I'll check with them and get an update on them from them on whether they thought the grant's appropriate or not. So it's one part of Prop 1, there are many grants, as you all know, and loans under that program, so we want to make sure we're spending our efforts on the ones that have the best chance of success. But we'll confirm that with Kestrel, and I'll shoot you an email back later this week to let you know where we're at with that.
Because I think that if you look at the application, it's really an intent to apply.
Right.
So it's very basic information that they're requiring. It just gets us a placeholder is what it's all about.
Okay. Thank you.
I had a couple of announcements. The first one is a follow-up from an announcement that I had made, I think it was in January of this year, and this is basically an update on EPA's Water Infrastructure and Resiliency Finance Center. So as you may recall, I mentioned that the whole purpose of this center is to promote innovative financing approaches and to support and expand capacity building efforts through collaborative technical assistance. So this is there's a big push by EPA Headquarters Office of Wastewater Management. A lot of funding is going into this. They're trying to get wastewater treatment facilities, municipalities talking to each other so that we could we end up with the very best projects possible. Some updates. This center is kicking off work to build financial capacity in small and medium disadvantaged communities, and it assists in identifying financing options to address community needs, and financing options include available funding sources and possible funding strategies. So your taxes are already paying for this, so we ought to really look into it, and I will give you this report after this meeting. Another thing is innovative state revolving fund financing. The center is launching a state revolving fund peer-to-peer learning program with the Council of Infrastructure Financing Authorities. The center is initiating a water infrastructure public-private partnership and public partnership study and local government training with the University of North Carolina Environmental Finance Center and West Coast Exchange. So there are a lot of things coming down the pike. I really think it would be useful to keep tabs on this one site. The center is focusing on stormwater financing by developing a clearinghouse of information to support communities to develop dedicated sources of revenue for stormwater programs. And this just showed up this week. EPA launched an e-newsletter on infrastructure financing. So it's called Water Finance E-News, and it will provide updates for those seeking and providing project funding. The newsletter will cover EPA's Clean Water State Revolving Fund, the Water Infrastructure and Resiliency Finance Center, Water Infrastructure Finance and Innovation Act program, amongst other things. So it's going to report on the latest program developments, trainings, and tools from these programs. And I'll just read out the website. It's http://water.epa.gov/about-ow, that's all one word, /ownews/subscribe.cfm. The second thing I wanted to mention was a report has just come out and it outlines ways to transform water treatment plants into water resource recovery facilities. And this report was issued by the Department of Energy, and it outlines a range of research and actions needed to transform today's water treatment plants into water resource recovery facilities that generate clean drinking water, biofuels, chemicals, and other water grades for specific uses like agriculture. So I know that we were talking about maybe piloting with some of the federal agencies, and I would suggest that you take a look at this new report. So basically what it was the results of an energy positive water resource recovery workshop, and it summarizes discussions and ideas presented at a workshop held by EPA, by DOE, and by the National Science Foundation. And then finally, I wanted to mention something that I came across on the web. And this is loan forgiveness for green projects. And this came from the State Water Resources Control Board. Basically, it says effective with the Clean Water State Revolving Funds 2015 Capitalization Grant from USEPA, the State Water Resources Control Board will provide a loan that's principal forgiveness to projects that address water or energy efficiency, mitigate stormwater runoff, or encourage sustainable project planning, design, and construction. And the State Water Board has approximately $30 million available in loan forgiveness from the 2015 capitalization grant. Okay? Were you aware of that?
I am aware that there are a number of loan forgiveness programs. Mm-hmm. One of the areas we've really pushed on the last month or so is getting our loan application together for SRF. Mm-hmm. Because as soon as we get that submitted, then we can work with that program manager to identify what those opportunities might be. There's a number of them out there.
Okay.
Related to recycled water, related to a bunch of different programs. So once we get that submitted, then we're in a position to start talking to them about that.
Okay, this was just announced at the end of October.
Okay.
And the limits are 50% of actual eligible costs, up to a maximum of $2.5 million for all measures consistent with the GPR guidance document. And it said that in terms of when to apply, but it also said that applications are continuously accepted.
Okay.
I have one question. That was a lot of information. But I heard in the middle of it all a deadline of December 1st. Is that of import?
That's for the letter of intent to pursue the grant. So we'll work with Kestrel to see whether this program is the right fit for us. We know they're looking at it, I'll shoot an email update out to WRFCAC to let them know.
Good.
But if it's appropriate, we'll go after it.
Good. I was there at that meeting at the OPC in Sacramento, and it's appropriate.
Okay.
And I'll be willing to talk to Kestrel if she doesn't find where I can connect it.
Okay, we have one other subcommittee. Thank you, Jenny.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
Very good. Steve, do you have anything to report?
Not at this time. So okay, engineering has something to report.
Okay, that gets us through that. That was part of announcements and presentations, and that gets us to public comment. And if there's anyone from the public that would want to step forward and give us their seeds of wisdom.
Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. My name is Nancy Castle, and I'm taking shameless advantage of being on TV to talk about Thanksgiving, which is a week from Thursday. We will be serving a meal here free at the community center from 1 to 3 p.m. It's going to be the full-on traditional turkey dinner, and we'd really like you to spread the words. If you can't make it, just let people know that this is available, and it is free, and we're going to have a lot of fun. There's going to be some great music and sing-alongs. We're going to have the Hokey Pokey Circle outside. I've got a leader to do that. I was talking about that last time. And it's going to be a real wonderful day. So, I just want to say I am incredibly grateful to all of you for your service to the community. And every day is Thanksgiving Day in Morro Bay.
So this is Thanksgiving Day.
Thanksgiving Day.
One to three here. And anybody and everybody can come.
Anybody and everybody.
Okay.
The more the merrier. Thank you.
Anyone else? Okay, seeing none, we'll proceed. This gets us to the consent calendar and the approval of the minutes from the previous meeting of November 3rd. Does anyone have any comments or concerns?
On the committee member comments, where I stated that.
Where are you?
At the very end.
Okay, D on the back page.
On the back page.
All right.
What I did say that the plant needs to be a reclamation plant, not a reclamation ready plant. A reclamation plant. So I just want that correction.
I move that we approve the minutes as stated, with the exception of what Richard Sadowski just brought up.
Or
the addition, I'm sorry.
Revision,
the addition
I,
of,
I should say.
Yeah, good point.
Okay.
With the addition of what Richard Sadowski brought up regarding about being a reclamation plan.
Okay. Second?
I'll second.
Okay, good. Any discussion? All in favor?
Aye.
Anyone opposed? No old business. That gets us to new business on the facility master plan update, and I would turn that over to Mike, sir.
Thank you. Today we have Matt Thomas with Black & Veatch. He'll be presenting he'll be providing a high-level overview of Technical Memorandum Number 7, the liquid treatment alternatives, and he'll also be here to respond to comments that you may have on Technical Memorandum Number 6. So one thing I wanted to kind of clarify from the meeting last time, what we've opted to do, these technical memoranda are going to be provided in complete stamped signed form to the Citizens Advisory Committee. And the reason is because they're, in many cases, are one piece of technical evaluation that are going to feed into the bigger master plan. So what I would encourage the committee to do is, as you're reviewing these tech memos, if you see technical issues that haven't been addressed, or if you see preferences or items that really need to be addressed in facility master plan, bring them to our attention. And if the goal is these technical memoranda inform the master plan. So it's not like that's going to be chapter 6 of the facility master plan as is. These are going to be technical reports that inform the master plan. So I want to encourage you to provide comments. What Black & Veatch is going to begin doing is we're going to begin recording the comments we receive from the committee, and we're going to create a comment sheet that's actually going to go in a table that's going to go in the draft facility master plan to reflect the comments that you all provide and what the resolution was, so that you can see that we're listening, we're incorporating the comments. I don't want you to feel like just because we're submitting final tech memos to you in some cases that you don't get a chance to inform the master plan. So I wanted to kind of clarify that.
And you are going to put these technical memorandums as an addenda to the master plan, will you not?
What they'll be is they'll likely be appendices in the back
appendices
of the master plan,
okay,
so that you can see the history of the document. And then the chapters of the master plan themselves will take that information, they'll refer to it. But really where your comments will be relevant to us is helping us steer the master plan based on these technical evaluations.
Okay, well, if it's okay with you, I would rather go through any comments that we have on 6 before we turn it over to Black & Veatch for 7.
Okay.
Is that all right with Black & Veatch?
Yep.
Okay, well, let's start with you, Steve. Do you have anything on 6?
Actually, I have no questions at this point in time. It read rather well. I was impressed with the document. These are more my opinions or observations of
what
I read in
for
it and what I'd like to see as they go forward. One is you negated the use of sludge beds, and I totally agree with that. We're living in a town where land is at a premium, and they take up space, and I totally agree with that observation they made. They brought up the fact as part of the alternatives of on-site composting, and I guess, did you want to speak on the sludge bed? Oh, okay. On the on-site composting, to me, right now we have Liberty Composting, there's Engel and Gray down Sand.
Could I interrupt you?
Sure.
Brad, let me introduce you so that if you want to come up to the podium, and I think an interfaced interaction is good, introduce yourself and then we'll proceed.
All right. I'm Brad Hemkin with Black & Veatch, representing the wastewater treatment reclamation technical team, really. So I just came up here to...
And you're welcome to stay there.
Yeah,
and we
yeah.
like the interface and the interaction,
okay.
So go ahead, Steve.
Right, great.
My concern was, I realize you look at the on-site composting as an alternative on this project. I see two, I don't know Liberty Composting personally, I do know Engel and Gray. There's a scalability to those kind of things that makes sense. I look at it when you read about either taking it to Coal Canyon landfill to give it to the composting people. It made more sense to me to go with the one of the local composters, either Angon Gray or Liberty Composting. It's actually cheaper, and the reuse of the biosolids actually happen, where if they take them out to Cold Canyon, it's just a cover on their landfill. And then the third thing was, I don't wish to see it dumped in the landfill. I think it requires a higher level of treatment of the biosolid prior to going to Cold Canyon. I realize somewhere in the future, maybe Angon Gray or Liberty may not be in business for whatever reason the state decides in their infinite wisdom to change the rules somewhere 10, 20 years out in the future. And I want most people to understand on-site composting, this is not compost people will use or put on ag lands. And I think you spelled it out a little bit in this document. It kind of goes to places where it doesn't come into human contact as readily as it would. So it's not like you're going to get a bag of manure like you'd buy down at Ace Miner or whatever. So, but other than that, it read real well. I felt real good with what you put on the biosolids.
Thank you.
Yeah, actually, since I've seen the plant now, and I know that the city at one time did try the composting, and I know now why we're not doing it, thanks to Bruce. But on that subject, on page 8 of the TM6, when it refers to the amount hauled, it's referring to cubic yards, but back in section 5, you're referring to tonnage and cost per ton. So I don't know if you can, on this table 2-3, include an approximate tonnage for these volumes. I think Bruce said they're up to about 300 yards already this year. So it's good to see the equivalent tonnage of these cubic yardage amounts on this part here. Also, I guess on the composting issue, what I understand from Bruce is that the green waste they have to bring to mix with it, it hasn't been a good quality, and that's one of the reasons why it's been a kind of a poor product, and they found themselves picking through trash out of the green waste, which I don't think we want our guys doing that. So right now it seems the way that we actually handle it by taking it to Liberty out in Lost Hills seems to be the most cost of way, and that again is because it's per ton and that's how it's measured and how it's done. So just that helps put the picture together.
That's very true. There is really probably nothing you can do that is going to be cost competitive to what you're doing right now.
That's what I see.
But the goal of that TM is also to kind of provide a range of ideas.
Right.
You know, for example, I think Steve mentioned if they go away in the future, mm-hmm. you know, what would it take to look at some alternative and provide the space planning that you could come in and do something different in the future if that cost-effective today option goes away sometime in the future. So,
thank you.
Thanks,
Paul. Nothing right now. You can come back to you. Barbara?
Thank you. No, I don't have the technical expertise to make any suggestions. However, I did think it read very well and was summarized well, so I appreciate that. That helps
thank
us.
Thank you.
Actually, on alternative 3.
No, and tell us what page. Where
it's
are
on
you?
Page 33. We are talking about. I think this is this in-vessel compost that would actually be land application as a soil amendment. I think Steve was saying that it's not a soil amendment as we would know it. So, it's. Class A of exceptional quality. So I don't know if that's quite right what Steve was saying, or am I missing something here?
I guess what I was alluding to, Valerie, is it can't be put on crop fields at this point in time in the state of California under its present use. It's generally used, I think, in areas where you don't come into much human contact, although I think they do allow it sometimes on golf courses or where you can walk on it, is that correct, Brad?
Yeah. As Class A material, you can use it on public lands,
but not on crop, correct?
Well, you can
do that.
I believe you can legally.
Oh, you can? Okay.
Yeah. You might be thinking there's a county biosolids ordinance, but I think the composting, does it get you around the biosolids ordinance?
Well, the county ordinance is dealing with class,
class B
land application, but with compost class A.
Right.
You know, I think it would be acceptable.
It could be used for those purposes. Okay.
And if you go to page 30, we do have the ordinance that restricts it to 1,500 whatever per year cubic yards. But the class A to be land applied in agricultural land annually or whatever. So it is used. I just wanted to clarify that.
Okay.
Got lots of microphones here.
Okay, Jenny.
So, right?
Yeah,
so
pull
know?
It towards you.
I agree with the comments that have already been said. I think the report was really well written, and it was very readable, easy to read. I didn't think it got bogged down in technical jargon at all. So with that said, basically, I have questions, and some of them I think are really for you. You know, starting with the project that we recently had, you had mentioned that you had been to the site and you saw that one of the reasons why we're no longer doing composting is it was just too complicated.
The quality of green waste wasn't very good, and spent a lot of their time trying to pick plastic and stuff out of it.
So that's why you got out of the business?
Well, the reason we eventually stopped composting was because we are at a point in that project where the sludge beds had the potential to be removed because that's where the new project would have gone. So we stopped composting at that point. One of the issues I talked with Valerie and Paul and Dale about was when we actually composted, we're mixing biosolids at about a 4-to-1 ratio with green waste, so it takes a lot of green waste. We had a hard time getting good green waste. We had all the local tree trimmers bringing us clean product. When we brought green waste back from the landfill, we actually had them deliver it to the treatment plant. There was a lot of plastic contamination in there, and so one of the issues that we struggled with is when we gave compost away, we didn't want a lot of plastics in our compost because even though it might not be from a sewage origin, the public doesn't see that when they see plastics in their compost. So we strive to do a really high-quality product. I think Brad's comments are very good, and Steve's as well is that we were able to compost about 40% of what we produced, and really the green waste was the critical path in there. But we're not necessarily cost-effective or competitive with people that are, you know, Liberty Farms is, I think their permit allows them to treat 200,000 tons of biosolids a year or something. I mean, it's a huge operation, so there's a lot of scale of economy, and so that's kind of why we stopped, is we sort of ran into that roadblock.
Okay.
But it was very well received when we did it.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, the fact that you went ahead with a pilot like that was very proactive, and so I was curious whether, you know, it was a money generator or not, but now I understand.
We gave it away. It was more of a disposal tool for us than, and actually the guy from Engle & Gray used to come into the plant and tell me, you're killing me because by not charging for the product, you're deeming it to be a waste product. And it's not a waste product, it's actually a resource. So you need to charge. But I wasn't in the business of trying to collect $20 here and $20 there. I wanted to see that material move off the treatment plant site.
Thank you. Mentioned that the goal was to develop a cost-effective technique, and it just didn't come. On page 8, this is regarding AB 1826. It said that although the bill doesn't include biosolids, it would require that commercial organics be sent someplace other than a landfill, and that this material could be composted or co-digested at the WRF and be a possible source of revenue. I'm just curious, how much additional land would be needed for a site, at the site, for this to occur, and what level of revenue could be generated by this?
We haven't gotten into that level of detail yet. Now, for composting, we have kind of honed in on in-vessel composting as opposed to, you know, a windrow operation that's, you know, spread out over a larger area, just to be more of a good neighbor facility. A windrow composting facility, it's taking up space. It's got to have odor control because there will be some odors associated with it. So in TM6, we've kind of honed in on in-vessel composting, which is a piece of machinery, if you will, a drum where the solids go in along with the green waste. It's mixed up, held in there for a period of time to get the heat and the contact time to create Class A. So we've kind of steered away at this point from, you know, a windrow composting operation. And in terms of the cost that could be, or the money that could be, the revenue that could be generated from composting, you know, we just have not gotten into that level of detail yet. That would come up in the facility master plan. If composting stays as an alternative that the group wants to analyze in detail, it's kind of hard to come up with that revenue estimate because you've got to do a market study. What is the market for composting? You know, people can go down to Home Depot and buy a bag of compost. So, you know, that if that's, you know, $2, $5, whatever it is, I'm not even sure, you know, what would the market bear to for the city to produce compost and sell it?
It doesn't sound like it's a very lucrative business.
It's probably
flowing around us.
It's probably, that's probably a very true statement, it really just comes down to a matter of sustainability and, you know, how sustainable, how large the sustainability appetite of the community is.
Now, the other thing I'll add in too is technical memorandum number 9 that Black and Veatch is working on addresses other organics, things like what are discussed in AB 1826. So what they're going to talk about in that tech memo is they're going to cite some regional efforts that are actually ongoing, because I think that's really informative countywide. And then they're also going to talk about things like fats, oil, and grease from restaurants and how that could be used to generate energy, and talk about all these different sorts of uses that aren't traditionally part of wastewater treatment, but that kind of get combined in there. So they'll have a tech memo where they talk about that from kind of a higher level.
Okay. Well, you just answered a couple of my questions.
Jamie, sorry, can you turn your microphone on?
I believe it is. Is it on now? Okay, well, you've just answered a couple of my questions.
Okay.
On 14, where you have your recommendations, you mentioned 4 thickening technologies, and you had suggested that they would go forward for further evaluation. And when I looked at the report, it just really seemed like only 2 came out instead of the 4, because one had an issue that was the gravity belt thickener technology had odor issues. I mean, I don't know how significant they are, but the way it read was like, I don't know if this is going to make it. And the other was the thickening centrifuge technology. It requires so much factory maintenance. So I thought that the only 2 that would really come out of that was the rotary drum and the screw thickener technologies. And so if we were to just focus on those 2, could you give just some general estimates of costs for those 2 technologies? Because what we're looking for is really I think we all have in mind the lowest cost facility using best available technology that generates the least amount of odor possible. Is that a correct statement?
Yeah, in terms of relative cost, those 2 technologies, the screw press and the drum thickener, are going to be less expensive than centrifuges. They will be on par with gravity belt thickeners. They are enclosed pieces of equipment such that you can pull the odorous air off of them and treat a smaller volume of air, if you will, for odor control. A gravity belt thickener is a fairly large device, and it's open. And so the way odors are dealt with on that piece of equipment is a hood put over the top of that item, and you pull a lot of air through because you want to pull the odorous air out, and you want to pull in enough air, you know, in addition to that to make sure you've captured all the... So you're dealing with a larger volume of air to odor treat. So, but on a capital cost, you know, those three are going to be fairly similar and would beat centrifuges, the rotary drum and the screw press, probably a simpler piece of equipment to deal with for odor control. But, you know, a lot of people use gravity bell thickeners as well.
So between those two that I just mentioned, there's really no huge difference in
no.
cost?
No, okay. No. And our thought is that, you know, this stage of the project is probably not really necessary to dive into, you know, whether or not a rotary drum thickener or a screw press is the ideal piece of equipment. Let the marketplace make that decision because they're equally... You know, they equally do a good job. You can provide odor control on both of them equally well. So our thought is, you know, at this stage, not tie that down and say it's got to be rotary drum thickeners or it's got to be screw presses. Take both of them forward to the next stage and let the marketplace decide.
Part of the advantage of what Brad's talking about is exactly what our thoughts have been on this, that with alternative delivery, you don't want to get too prescriptive with each piece of equipment because you want to give, if it's design build that you go with, you want to give that contractor the opportunity to pull together what makes the most sense, what meets the things you really care about. You can button up the odor control. You can nail down what you exactly have to have. You can make them report on, project what the energy efficiency will be, what the O&M costs will be. You can build that all into that procurement package that you use to go get a design builder, for example. But we want to leave that open because we want, like Brad said, we want the market to decide that for us based on what we really care about.
Okay, fair enough. Mm-hmm. Let's see. You mentioned on page 26, this is the combination dewatering vacuum drying system. This is just a question. When was the JVAC evap system by, I think it's pronounced Evoqua Water Technologies?
Formerly Siemens, yeah.
You said it was recent?
It's been around for 10-15 years. You know, time flies, but it's been around for, especially when you get to be my age, time really flies. But anyway, it's probably been around 10-15 years.
So are there other technologies that are similar?
Not really. That's fair. That's a unique one.
Okay.
And the advantage is you don't treat the solids. You just use that piece of equipment, and it's a combination dewatering device and heat dryer. You know, it's kind of a combination of the old, not to get too technical, those old plate and frame device where you put the solids in, you squeeze the plates together to dewater. That's the first step of this device, but then they run steam through it. They pull a vacuum to lower the boiling point of water, run steam through it to evaporate off the moisture, and you end up with 99% dry solids. So, you know, it's not cheap, and there's a lot of energy that goes into it with the steam. The advantage is that you've got a thimble full of dry solids to truck off as opposed to truckloads. You know, you get the volume reduced and minimize the hauling cost. That's really the advantage of it.
Yeah, it sounded really promising.
It's not, but it's not cheap.
Okay, and then just I think you've answered the question in terms of whether our biosolids are a product or a waste. I was hoping that maybe Cal Poly, we could develop some sort of a partnership with them, and they might be able to use it. Either we give it to them or, you know, at some minimal cost. But from what you said, it sounds like...
It's going to go to a composting agency. Engel and Gray and Liberty Composting, they turn it into compost. So it's being a reused product going that route. To take to the landfill, it's strictly cover. And the county does have a lot of requirements on their cover material. So it makes more sense to me to go to the composting outfits because it will be reused in that fashion.
Okay.
It's just doing it locally. Are you going to be able to do it cheaper, faster, better than, say, Engel and Gray or Liberty?
Right.
And you're not. At least in my mind, that's my opinion, but that's how I see it.
And you're talking about the Cold Canyon?
Yeah, if it went to Cold Canyon, what they do is they cover the landfill, basically, every once in a while, and they use this product as mm-hmm. its cover.
Okay. That's it. Thank you.
Thank you, Jenny. Richard.
In your analysis on the composting, are you mitigating any of the costs for the greenhouse gas recapture with those options? When you're looking at the different options, because that'll open up grant funding for us if we have that in.
We haven't got to that level of detail yet. You know, TM6 and TM7, and as you'll see here in a minute, is laying out the technologies to carry forward for that level of analysis in the facility master plan. So the simple answer is no, we haven't got to that level of detail yet.
You know, I ride my bike around town a lot, and had a lot of people, especially the older people that live here, and this is more of a general comment here, a general with the facilities master plan. Let me paint you a little vignette.
Let's stay on target here.
Well, this
we're,
is
we're
target.
On six.
Well, we're on facilities master plan, right?
No, we're on six. We're on technical memorandums.
One thing I would want to point out, that today's a little different from other days in terms of schedule, because we do have to be out of here at 4.
Yeah.
So I just want to point that out. We're glad, you know, we'd like to leave. I think Black and Veatch probably needs, Matt, you guys probably need about a half hour.
Half hour, 45 minutes.
That do it for you guys? So I just, again, I don't want to cut anybody off or anything like that. I just want to make sure everybody knows we do have a time limit today based on availability of the room and production staff, I believe.
Okay, well, Richard's going to have to leave us early today because of other commitments. So if you can make this short, Richard, you can jump the track.
Okay. It is related, okay, because here's the process, okay? If you were presented, okay, with two architects, one architect comes up to you and says, "Oh, okay, you're going to hire an architect," and he says, "Okay, we're going to build this house where it's going to go neoclassical, maybe a little Baroque, but not too Rococo, and all this stuff that you know that thing," and then here's a bill, okay? So we're building this house, and we're spending $10,000-$15,000 designing this thing, facilities master plan. Another architect asks you a question: how big is your lot? Okay? We don't even have a lot yet. Okay? So we're spending a lot of money. It looks like the carriage in front of the horse here. You know, we need to secure some property or make that decision before we get all these two technical memorandums and different technologies and all this stuff. We need to get into a box where we can coordinate with where the funding is and make sure our projects coordinate with that funding and just make it the smallest footprint, because land is very valuable. And if you look at it that way, okay, it seems to me like we're doing a lot of this option, but we got to get a place first to build this thing. So a facilities master plan without land is really, it's kind of like the same thing we did over at the treatment plant. We're existing. I see kind of a Groundhog's Day situation. All this money being spent, literally hundreds of thousands of dollars, and nothing came of it.
Thanks.
So I can speak to that. Valerie, I know you had kind of raised your hand. I know if you had a comment to add to that. Or
I think it's probably what you're going to say is in regards to the FNP, that it's going to be coordinated with the property negotiations with and you know, so, and they're also looking at other locations as well. It's not all these technical memos from my perspective are just options for the treatment of different kinds of things.
Oh, okay, Mike.
Mike, can go ahead.
Did you want to add to that?
Yes, sir. And Valerie's right. The way I would put it is, the analysis we're doing right now is to help us figure out, for one, how much land we need when we look at different property options, and then how much land we need is going to drive nailing down one of those handful of alternatives. So you're right; they both got to happen, and they're both moving forward as quickly as we can get them to, without either duplicating effort and also without doing things we have to go back and undo because we've settled on a site. So we're balancing those, and I totally hear your frustration and concern. And I can tell you right now that it's noted, and we're doing everything we can to keep both efforts moving together at the same time without spending money that is not going to get us down that path. So,
okay. Then my only comment is thanks, everyone, for very, very good input on 6. My only question would be is on 8 and 9, you say regulations that are relevant to biosolids are all AB bills. I don't know. I know this is a fairly recent document. Is there any update on any or all of those bills, those three bills that are mentioned in 6, AB 18, 26, 15, 94, and especially AB 341? I thought that was kind of interesting, where you have to take not less than 75% of the solid waste generated be source reduced and recycled or composted by 2020. Is there any update on any of those bills? Did they go through?
Yeah.
Are they just, committee or people flapping their wings up there or what?
I'm going to have to get some help with it. Do we know the answer to that?
We don't know. They are still in committee.
I didn't hear that.
Sandeep says they're still in committee.
They're still in committee.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's about it, staff.
Can I ask one more thing as a result of what came up around the board here?
Okay.
It's real quick. In your analysis between the anaerobic and aerobic digestion,
yeah,
and it was very close, I thought, after all was said and done, and some of it's subjective by nature, how you go through those kind of weightings. I guess my question to you is, you talk about you make methane with an anaerobic digester,
right,
and there's that use for the power of methane, everything else. Have you looked at how much heat it takes to run the anaerobic digester? Because I don't think aerobic requires heat. It just requires the air pump through it to make it work.
Right.
I'm just wondering, are you going to be pumping more to it, or is there enough methane made to run the anaerobic digester?
Yeah, generally there is enough methane to run the digester with a little bit of excess left over. Yeah, I tell you, Steve, I did want to come back to that specific aspect of TM6, anaerobic versus aerobic digestion, or no treatment at all at the end of the TM7 discussion. Oh, okay. So
that's fine. I could table it till then.
Bruce would like to add a little.
You know, currently we have anaerobic digesters on site. And we have two natural gas boilers that we use to heat those digesters. Based on our current gas production, they're pretty much 100% self-sufficient. So they're like 99% of their heat.
When I deal with a scale this small, I wasn't quite sure you were making the amount of methane to even heat up the anaerobic digester.
We still flare gas, and it's always been, it always has kind of bothered me that we couldn't put like some sort of cogen project together. But our I don't think, similar to the composting, we're so small, we have a hard time doing it because we don't make enough gas. Right. But we can heat the digester.
And then you have to scrub the gas if you're using it for an internal combustion engine or something like that. Thank you. Oops, thank you.
Okay, before we move on, though, I would like to give the public a crack at this. At number six, before we move on to seven, does anyone in the public have any comments after all of this discussion on TM6? Okay. Mike, we're ready for seven, I think.
Okay. Well, I'm going to turn it back over to Black and Veatch, and
I jumped in here.
Ask if
you guys want to have some preempt on seven. Okay, just take it away.
Three bills.
All right. Okay.
Okay.
All right. TM7. Before I go ahead, I'm kind of representing the wastewater water reclamation treatment team. I want to introduce Jake Holden. He helped author TM7 extensively, and Sandeep. Sandeep's our professor, PhD. He does. I'm sorry. He does our process modeling, and so if we get into any real heavy duty technical wastewater treatment questions, I might need to rely on Sandeep to help me a little bit. But. We'll just play that by ear. I'll probably be okay. Let's see. Which one goes? There we go. Okay. Reviewing TM7. Now, you guys haven't seen this yet, so this is kind of a preview of what you're going to see. Just a quick slide on schedule here. We're on schedule. TM7 has been submitted to the staff, and you guys will be seeing it shortly. Just to kind of frame where we're at in the project, last time the results of TM2 were presented, which is the flow and loadings. We're going to talk about TM6 and 7, which is technology discussion for liquid treatment and solids treatment. We've looked at a number of technologies, and so the point of TM6 and 7 is to hone in on the preferred technologies, the best fit technologies, if you will, for this facility. So then when we combine the results of TM6 and 7 with the flow and loadings from TM2, that gives us the basis to do some preliminary design in the facility master plan where we can size these facilities, do site layouts, come up with cost estimates. Okay? So just to frame where we're at today.
So just to interrupt you, after TM7, we will review we will have comments on TM7 next meeting, December 1st.
Right.
And that would mean that we would leap directly to the FMP from there?
Right.
One thing that I would request for TM7, so we have our joint council and citizens advisory committee meeting on December 1st, and that's when Black and Veatch is going to be presenting kind of a version of this. It's going to be more publicly accessible, I guess. Not that this isn't, but what we're looking for are comments that you have in advance of that that could help with the presentation, or technical comments you have. What I would really appreciate, if there's any way you all could email those to me in advance, then Black and Veatch could be prepared to address them at the presentation, and it might also help them. It would also really help them steer how they put it together.
Okay.
So that'd be really helpful.
So you're asking us as a committee to try to respond to seven rather than in this forum to throw email to you in advance for the December 1 because there's going to be a lot of other people involved.
Yes, sir. And what I thought would be, you know, and you can come and be, you know, and be prepared to talk about the comments and things you've shared with us.
Yeah.
But it would give us a chance to be prepared.
Yeah.
And it would also help us refine or could help us redirect how that presentation comes together.
Okay, everybody hear that?
Yep.
Okay, good.
Yeah, so this is really a key step because it establishes the alternatives we want to carry forward and look at in detail in the facility's master plan. So this is a key step. And so if you've got any questions as we go through this today, you know, just something occurs to you, just please interrupt and don't have to wait for December 1st. So, okay, just a introduction here. What we're talking about is establishing a wastewater treatment train, we like to call it, which is a series of building blocks, treatment steps, if you will, that are aligned in a series of treatment blocks to get to the end product that we want to get to. The top line here is, you know, basic treatment, preliminary treatment, primary treatment, secondary biological treatment, filtration, tertiary filtration, and disinfection. We're going to go through each of those steps in a little bit of detail, but that is the building block train, if you will, that's been established by the city as the minimum level of treatment for this facility. And it gives you a water that's good for, it exceeds what you would need for continued ocean discharge, but it gives you a water that would be good for either restricted or unrestricted Title 22 irrigation.
What is IPR?
IPR is indirect potable reuse.
Oh.
Okay, so that's the base, the top row is the baseline level of treatment. So now if we want to talk about higher end uses, we need to start talking about advanced treatment, which is a deviation or, a parallel or an alternative track to tertiary and disinfection in its advanced treatment, and that creates a water that's good for groundwater recharge, avocado irrigation, because avocados are salt sensitive, so they need some advanced treatment to take salts out, and then the highest, highest level of reuse we're talking about in this study is indirect potable reuse, which is recharge into a drinking water quality aquifer, some environmental, buffer with a minimum amount of travel time, and then extracting that water after that contact time for potable purposes. And that is advanced treatment. So I'm going to just walk through the top row here in preliminary treatment is screening and grit removal. It's physical treatment up front to take out the big contaminants, if you will. And there are a number of acceptable options to screen wastewater and remove grit. And this falls in the same camp as the solids thickening equipment. We think it's better to just carry forward and dictate that screening is going to be required, and the level of screening, a quarter inch perforated screen, dictate the level of screening that you want in this facility and dictate grit removal to be included in the facility. But since there are so many acceptable options for those two steps, let the marketplace dictate and determine which pieces of equipment go in. Questions on that?
After nope. That goes to the digester, what you're pulling off the screen, or is it going somewhere else?
Screens, the screenings come off, goes through a compacting device and a washing device such that the end result is dry, clean material.
Oh, okay.
And the organics that are washed off get returned back to the process in liquid form, so it goes through the process. So what you end up with is it looks a lot like blown-in insulation. It's a fairly dry confetti material, and that just gets hauled off.
Oh, okay.
Same with grit. Okay, next step is primary treatment. And I want to talk a little bit about primary treatment at the end of this in conjunction with solids management. Primary treatment is really optional, and for a facility of this size, it's kind of an optional treatment step. There's advantages and disadvantages to including primary treatment. Primary treatment removes solids, it reduces the organic load on the downstream facilities, allows you to economize on those downstream facilities. It also pulls out organic material that is needed in the downstream facilities to drive nitrogen removal. So if you take that organic load out in primary treatment and you find yourself short in the downstream process to remove nitrogen, you have to come in and add chemical nitrogen. So there's pros and cons to primary treatment. We're taking that as an optional to the FMP, the Facility Master Plan stage, and we're going to do sizing and cost analysis with and without primary treatment. So we can see how those pros and cons play off of one another. Okay, secondary biological treatment is the heart of a wastewater treatment plant. That's where the bulk of the work's being done. You guys have been through this process a number of times. I don't want to bore you, so cut me off if this is too basic. Just kind of a wastewater treatment 101. What we're doing here is we're using microbiology to consume the organics in the wastewater. It's just a natural process. It's occurred naturally over, you know, eons. So what we're doing in a wastewater treatment plant is we're concentrating that biological population and bringing it in contact with wastewater to speed that process up, basically, is what we're doing. And so every biological treatment plant has some kind of biological reactor, and there's a number of different configurations and styles of this. I'll talk a little bit about that. But they all, and there's nothing new here, there's no silver bullet, there's no patented process, nobody has got, a magic bullet here. They all require some kind of biological reactor where you're concentrating that biology in a vessel. And that's where the work's being done. And then the liquid flows onto some sort of separation device where that biology is separated from the liquid and returned back to the biological tank. And then some of those solids are pulled off as waste to control the concentration of the biology in that loop. So, as I mentioned, there's a number of ways to do that and a number of configurations and styles of types of treatment to provide that biological treatment. These are the kind of the gambit of those technologies. Some of them are suspended growth systems where that biology is in a tank, and that tank is mixed to keep the solids from settling. It's also aerated because these bacteria are aerobic bacteria. They need dissolved oxygen to work efficiently. So, and there's a number of styles of suspended growth systems. There's also what's called fixed film systems, where there's a media in that vessel, in that tank, and the bacteria attach themselves to the media. The wastewater is distributed and trickled through that media, and that's where the contact between the wastewater and the biology occurs. But it's all of those have a media. The biology grows on that media, and that's where their interface happens. And then there are some hybrid systems, which, you know, for example, the integrated fixed film activated sludge system is a hybrid. It's a combination of suspended growth system and fixed film system in that you've got the same biological tank with the bacteria floating in it, and it's mixed. There's also media, small quarter-sized media that's put in that tank. Some of the bacteria attach themselves to that media, so you get, you know, a higher concentration of bacteria in the same volume with the suspended growth and the fixed and the attached growth component on the media. So what you can do in that system is get more concentration of bacteria in that same footprint and get more capacity out of the same footprint. So you'll read a description of all of these technologies in TM7, and we talk about the pros and cons of all of them, and we come down to three technologies that we selected to go through a scoring phase, a qualitative scoring phase, to identify the best or most appropriate technology for this facility out of all of these. You know, some of them you'll read, you know, for example, I mentioned this integrated fixed film. It's a great technology. Its place is it's a best fit, if you will, for an existing facility that's already got an activated sludge plant. You just put some, you know, screens to retain that media, put the media in the tank. It's a great fit to expand an existing plant capacity in the same footprint. For a new facility, not so much, because there's, you know, there's a cost to that media. There's a cost to the stainless steel screens that are required to keep the media in the tank. So not a good fit for a brand new facility. So we talk about, I'm not going to go into pros and cons for all of those, but we talk about the pros and cons like that for each of these technologies. And what we come down to is for further analysis is all suspended growth systems, activated sludge, sequencing batch reactors, and oxidation ditches. Those are all variations on, you know, a suspended growth facility. So an activated sludge plant is, you know, pretty simple. As I was already alluding to, the media is contained in a tank. A tank's mixed and aerated, and then the biology is separated in a final clarifier. Some of it is returned back to the process to maintain that concentration of biology. Some of it's wasted. Now, the nice thing about suspended growth systems like activated sludge is very amenable to biological nitrogen removal. And this facility is going to require nitrogen removal down to 10 milligrams per liter per Title 22. So the way that's done is the aeration tanks are separated into multiple zones. The first zone is anoxic. It's still aerobic bacteria, but it's unaerated, and that's followed by anoxic zone, which is aerated. And what's done here is the ammonia in the wastewater is converted to nitrate, NO3, in that oxic zone. Some of that is recirculated, and the NO3, the O is stripped off and provides the aeration for the biology in the anoxic zone, and the nitrogen is released to atmosphere. That's how biological phosphorus or biological nitrogen removal works. And if you add another stage, you can do biological phosphorus removal as well. So that's one of the advantages of activated sludge facilities. Suspended growth, we're running out of time. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, let me speed up. SBR, sequencing batch reactor. The difference here is that's one tank, and you do everything in one tank. You fill it, you aerate it, you turn the air off, it settles, you decant. So the biological treatment and the solid separation all occurs in one vessel. The advantage of SBRs is it's a very modular technology. It allows you to add other tanks easily to keep pace with growth, keep pace with flow increases much more easily than a traditional activated sludge plant. Oxidation ditch is just another form of activated sludge. It's designed with a very long hydraulic retention time, 24 hours, the idea being that a longer hydraulic retention time provides for a more stable operation. The disadvantage is that the footprint with that long is much larger, and the aeration is not as efficient in a traditional activated sludge plant. So, but those are the three technologies that we can carry forward for conventional treatment for a scoring phase, and we identified these criteria to use to score those three options, and we gave a weight to those scoring criteria and then assigned a number, you know, relative cost, you know, a number from 1 to 5, 5 being the absolute best, 1 being the absolute worst. And at the end of the day, when we rolled all of that up, we're coming down with SBR as the recommended conventional treatment technology for this facility.
Just out of curiosity, I don't see a electrical energy element in your ranking. Is that a factor? It must not.
Yeah, no, it is. It is. The second criteria, operating cost here, primarily energy. We're dealing with staff, you know, labor cost. I'm sorry, down here in a staff requirements criteria. So this is primarily energy cost and chemical cost.
Oh, all right. And is that a big deal?
Yeah.
Is it?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely.
I noticed it called for final, no need for final clarifiers. Are you still going to require a primary clarifier?
Well, again,
on an SBR system, I wasn't sure.
Any of these technologies can operate with or without primary clarification.
Oh, okay.
It's just a matter of sizing the downstream treatment accordingly.
Oh.
If the advantage again of a primary clarifier is removing some organic load, allows you to, you know, downsize the biological step. So.
Okay. Thank you.
We're gonna look at SBR with and without primary clarifiers and do the cost analysis and, you know, life cycle cost analysis, which is capital cost and operating cost. So, okay. So after biological treatment is filtration. And we looked at two types of filters, disc filters and media filters. This is a picture of a disc filter, which is, as described, is a series of discs with a woven cloth material or plastic material or stainless steel material that the water passes through and that material filters out particulates. Media filters are granular media filters like you would see in a potable water treatment plant, sand filters basically, you know, like your pool filter. Not exactly, but kind of like. So the same process was used for the filtration step, a series of scoring criteria and then a score and weighting and then a score 1 to 5 for each of those criteria relatively, you know, relative from one technology to the other. And the disc filters scored best on the Title 22 filtration criteria. So then, again, on conventional treatment, the last step is disinfection.
and we looked at UV disinfection versus chlorine disinfection. We considered, we also talked about, we talk about ozone disinfection in the in TM7. However, ozone disinfection is very expensive, both in terms of capital cost and energy. So it was dropped from further consideration. So we applied scoring criteria to UV disinfection and chlorine disinfection only. And UV disinfection came out with the highest score. So we'll close the loop on that conventional treatment train in a minute, but before we do that, I'm going to talk a little bit about advanced treatment, which is required you instead of tertiary filtration and conventional disinfection, again, for these higher end uses, IPR, most notably, IPR in Title 22 regulations for IPR, indirect potable reuse, dictates advanced treatment with RO and advanced oxidation processes. So, I mean, there's not really a whole lot of room to consider alternatives. So what we're talking about for advanced treatment for IPR is MFRO plus advanced oxidation. And the what's been used pretty much exclusively for advanced oxidation is UV peroxide, where add hydrogen peroxide and then run that through UV. The UV splits off the hydroxyl radicals, which is a very potent disinfectant and will oxidize chemicals and, you know, gives you a very high log removal for viruses and so on. This is MFRO, you've got to have some high level of pretreatment for RO because RO is very susceptible to clogging from, you know, minute solids, even silt. So the pretreatment for RO is MFRO. I happened to do the first MFRO plant in the country back in the 90s, and prior to that it was lime treatment. Lime softening and filtration, which was the process that was used, you know, originally at the Water Factory 21 in Orange County. But since that point in time, since we piloted this, this job was the first large-scale MFRO plant in the country. Ever since that, this has become the standard. MF as pretreatment for RO. That's today. That's the standard. And this is just a picture of MF, which is now being used at the Water Factory 21 down in Orange County. RO, this is, just a large number of RO vessels. It's not much different than an RO under your sink if you've got RO treatment at home. I mean, you know, technically it's pretty much the same thing. I mean, it not exactly, but you know, just for this is a picture of the today GWRS, formerly Water Factory 21 at Orange County. And this is a picture of Orange County's advanced oxidation process. Again, it's a combination of hydrogen peroxide with UV to create hydroxyl radicals for disinfection. So to come back to close the loop on all of that, this is alternative one that we're recommending be carried forward to the facility master plan for detailed analysis and sizing and costing. And it consists of, preliminary treatment. We're going to look at it with and without primary clarification again. SBR, disc filters, UV disinfection for regular Title 22 reuse, and then MFRO
for higher end reuses, either, you know, initially or in the future, and perhaps even in combination with Title 22 reuse and perhaps IPR. So that's.
I had a quick question if I could. In the earlier ones, before you had the advanced treatment, there was two different types of uses. It was ocean outfall and I think indirect recharge. What do you see the BOD levels coming out of this plant if you did not get into the advanced treatment side?
Five.
Oh, it's that low. Okay.
Five or less.
Oh, okay. Thank you.
Probably less. Five max. Yeah. Okay. So now, this is our recommended conventional treatment train to carry forward to the facility master plan. We also are recommending another technology going forward to the facility master plan in parallel with that recommended conventional treatment train, and that is a membrane bioreactor. And what a membrane bioreactor is basically, just to come back and review a little bit here, a conventional plant has got a, you know, activated sludge facility, a clarifier, and microfiltration, and you can put RO right here. Now, in our case of conventional, we're combining this into a batch operation for an SBR, but it still is activated sludge with some separation technique. What an MBR is an activated sludge tank with membranes put into the tank, and the effluent is drawn out through those membranes. And so what you've got is you've got the solid separation step and microfiltration combined all in one tank.
Did you do that process with the evaluation criteria that you went through to get to the first alternative?
No. What we're recommending is both of these go forward to the facility master plan stage, and we'll do sizing on both of them and cost comparison of both of them in the facility master
plan. That's in the future. This will not be in 7?
No, that's 7 is establishing what we want to take forward to the facility master plan step. And so what we're saying is we want to take two alternatives forward to that facility master plan, an SBR alternative and an MBR alternative.
And you'll compare those two processes with all those criteria?
No, we're going to do sizing, site layout, cost estimate, both capital cost and operating cost.
There you go.
So, you know, we'll have a very good comparison of those two alternatives.
And the Coastal Commission doesn't have any problem with either of those processes?
No.
Okay.
No. Is the advantages of an MBR that may or may not come out when we do the detailed cost estimating is, but we think there's promise there. It's a smaller footprint because you're combining the biological treatment and the solid separation. You've already got, you know, an order of magnitude. Those disc filters are going to give you an NTU effluent of 1. The membranes are going to give you an NTU of 0.1. So you're an order of magnitude better quality of water that can go on to RO. You don't have to have another membrane step to go to RO. So you can go straight from MBR to RO. Smaller footprint. Do you have a question?
No.
Oh,
I might have notes for later.
Okay. Smaller footprint, you know, which facilitates a good neighbor facility, facilitates a smaller amount of air that's got to be pulled off of the facility for odor control. So there's a number of advantages, and, you know, it really, really comes down to a cost comparison. So this is what an MBR train would look like. Again, you know, preliminary treatment, of course,
optional primary clarification. One thing on an MBR is you do have to include fine screens down to a point, down to a 2 millimeter fine screen facility to remove any hair or such that can wrap themselves around the membranes. And then you've got activated sludge combined with the membranes, and then you can go right on to RO. So that's what an MBR is. TM6, we talked about that, and I don't think I want to, you know, the
no,
point
we nailed that.
Yeah. So that's TM7.
Okay. Well, do we have any questions for Brad at this point?
I'm unfamiliar with MBRs. I know SBRs fairly well. Is there a lot of operational cost involved in clearing the membranes? How do they actually clear the membranes? Is it a black back flushing kind of a thing?
Yes.
Is that how they do it?
No. Yeah. This is a, if you got a minute, this is a facility that I did in Peoria, Arizona. It's a 10 MGD. It's an MBR facility. You know, stuff is, you know, the headworks is here, the screens, solids is here, the aeration tanks are here, membrane tanks are here. Those things are a series of membranes in that tank. By the way, you know, this thing is sitting right next to a very large city park in Peoria, softball field, soccer field, city courtyard sits right here. So, you know, that thing is really integrated into the community.
Hey, Brad, I'm going to have to interrupt you because we have another meeting in here.
Okay, I'm sorry.
So we have we have to close button this one up.
Sorry,
so,
I could talk.
No, there's no sorry.
I could talk about this stuff all day.
It's not yours. It's me. And so what I'm going to ask the our committee to do is look at TM7. And Mike has asked us to comment back to him. What email address do you want, Mike?
You can send it. I'll send you an email after I'm done today with my email address, and you all can just respond to that. What I would ask you to do is don't CC all, because we're trying to...
Okay, just one-on-one.
Brown Act, but just shoot one
just
back.
Just respond.
If I could get it back from you by, say, next Tuesday, so a week from today, that would be ideal, because that would give me time to forward to Black and Veatch before the holiday. They could be really prepared to address comments in their presentation the following Tuesday. Mm-hmm. So,
okay. I'm going to skip close. I usually go around the table, and since we're pushed against time and I think we need to put this to bed, so I'm going to ask us to comment to Mike. I know it's hard to respond to something like this, especially this technical, on the, you know, when you're doing it on the go. And it's and so we do have time, though. We got a week at home. And so take technical memorandum 7 home. Think about it. And feel free to forward any comments to you directly.
Yes, sir.
But you're going to email us all, so we don't have to worry about getting your address down or anything like that.
Yeah, that's correct.
You look like you want to say something.
I just want to take 1 minute to thank everybody for their participation and input with the Water Reclamation Facility Citizens Advisory Committee. And some of you, unfortunately, could not make the advisory body appreciation event last night. So I have certificates for everybody. Dale.
Thank you.
Valerie.
Pass that over to Valerie.
Bill.
Thank you.
I think that is everybody.
Everybody else showed up.
But before I close, I think it's very important to give the public an opportunity to come up to the podium and make any statement they think appropriate from the presentation, especially on TM7. Is there anyone from the public that would want to make a comment at this time? Okay, then how about comments on anything else before we adjourn? How about anybody want to make a comment from our committee? Okay, then I adjourn this meeting as of now, and we will meet at the Vets Hall, 4 p.m., December 1st, at our next scheduled meeting. And don't forget the emails to Mike.
How you doing?